This episode is brought to you by Aura. That's O-U-R-A. The Aura Ring, from my perspective, is the single best wearable on the market. I use it to measure my sleep, activity, and readiness on a daily basis. I bought my Aura Ring several months ago before talking with the company's CEO on the podcast. I haven't taken it off since. I believe what gets measured gets managed. So if you care at all about your health, which you should, you have to measure your sleep in order to manage it. Aura measures much more than just my time in bed. It tracks my REM sleep versus deep sleep, my resting heart rate and heart rate variability, my temperature, my activity, and much, much more. For $299, you can get your own Aura Ring on AuraRing.com. That's O-U-R-A-R-I-N-G.com. AuraRing.com. Okay, let's get into it. Thank you so much, George, for taking the time and joining me on the show today. I've been looking forward to the conversation for a while now. You're well known on Twitter for sharing these sort of mental models. You've got this this Clouds and Dirt newsletter, which is really interesting. You actually created NavalBot on Twitter, which like goes and resurfaces Naval Ravikant's tweets, and it's got like over 100,000 followers. I think your own Twitter has almost that much. I think like 70,000 followers, something like that. So basically have made just sort of made something for yourself out of nothing on Twitter, on a couple accounts, doing a couple different things. And you also have this like marketing agency, I understand. So I want to talk about all this stuff, but I think first best place to get started would just be to sort of hear your story, from as early as you're willing to go back to where you are today. And then we'll go from there.
Let's do it, man. First off, thanks for having me on. I've listened to quite a few episodes and I've been enjoying it. So it's quite weird to, hear your voice and be able to reply to it this time. So yeah, in terms of the story, English accent, born in the UK, just a bit of a weird, curious kid. Just went down a lot of rabbit holes when I was younger, some suitable for the podcast, some not suitable for the podcast. And that got me fascinated by the internet, technology, ideas, just the amount of information you could get. I went to university to study philosophy, and I realized after the first lecture, I was like, this is shit. You're not really learning anything. Hmm. And I quickly began to just use the internet to learn more and more and more, as well as trying to apply more and more and more. That then got me into the realm of like, a crossover. My two passions are psychology and technology, which quite nicely fits into like digital marketing. So I was then at an agency called Social Chain, doing lots of stuff on the innovation side of things there, like scaling up like huge marketing campaigns and huge media companies, like just as it was starting, like social media. And then yeah, do a lot of different things like growth wise marketing for a variety of a few YC companies, a few huge e-commerce companies that are scaling. I just find the internet fantastic, man. So that's the loose story so far, but it just means tinkering around and seeing what's happening and applying sort of the sweet spot of the Venn diagram between psychology and technology that I love.
Yeah, it's awesome. I like the intersection of psychology and technology myself, and can certainly appreciate wanting to like dive in and applying that to sort of social media or marketing in general and all of that sort of category of things. Did you start on Twitter? Were there signs before sort of developing your Twitter brand that, you know, other interests that you took on at like a younger age, or was Twitter like the first thing where you really felt, you know, the quote unquote internet was really starting to work for you?
Yeah, I'd say I had a very weird hobby when I was younger. So my dad bet me I couldn't do 10 kickups with a football. And I took that to a disgusting length of training every day for 4 hours. And then I was like in like an Adidas advert. I was like, oh shit. And that was through the internet. I was like, okay, this is really interesting. So it begins to scale. And then Twitter, it was just tinkering around. And that just begins to do anything. But often it's just naturally just following like a passion point rather than having a specific plan. So, but the Twitter one was the most interesting. It's, I think we were discussing this just before the podcast began, but there's been a lot on online dating, but there's not been much on online friendship. And like the likelihood of you meeting somebody as a friend in the real world, quote unquote, the likelihood of you having similar interests is so slim. But when it comes down to the likelihood online, the affinity is so much higher. So I'm fascinated by the internet in that regard, like the ability to meet friends that have similar affinities and similar interests.
So have you seen, like, so for me, we you know, we discussed this a bit earlier, but for me, like, I grew up and, you know, had my friends from quote unquote real world and still have these friends. And only within the last year or two have I really started meeting people on the internet, you know, specifically most of the time on Twitter. And you're right, there's this, I think it's just basically everyone sort of based on what they tweet out or what they write about on their blog or talk about on their podcast, they put out this sort of signal, which then attracts, you know, people who are down with that signal or whatever it is. Whereas in real life, you just sort of meet people based on geographic proximity or friend to friend or whatever it might be. So I think there is like this tendency of a higher, you know, there's like more synergy on the average introduction, basically. How have you seen, like, have your, like I said, I'm only like a year or two into this. Have your, like, the people you talk to on a regular basis, your friends who you like rely upon or rely on you, has this mix become more like internet based over the last several years that you've been into all of this?
Yeah, massively. Don't get me wrong, there's still a lot of, I have a lot of amazing friends from the real world. Sounds like you're playing Ready Player One, right? I have a lot of friends from the real world. However, there's certainly a lot more agency that comes to meeting people online, where I was always fascinated by that college experience of you have somebody called Susan or Graham who sat there with a spreadsheet that decides on who you're going to be in, like in the UK anyway, like what accommodation you're in. And just the chance of that spreadsheet or the chance of so many random variables, that person then ends up becoming your best friend for the next 3 years. And it's like, realistically, if you actually looked at from a, like, if you broke down your individual personalities, are you got the best fit, like friend fit? Probably not, but you just kind of rely on chance. But I think the internet has kind of taken that away. Don't get me wrong, it can go the other way. You can meet serial killers online. It's a bit of a barbell. However, the upside is incredible. One thing I have noticed though, is that you can't quite build up the relationship online as of yet, or as well as if you have one meeting in person. So let's say you have 100 Zoom calls. I'd way rather have like 100 Zoom calls versus one meeting in person and 99 Zoom calls. It's like you need that in-person meeting, I find, to compound the Zoom calls. Like, you all need is one in-person meeting and it makes them a lot more effective. So there's still something to be said about meeting in person. However, once you've got a few meetings in person, like I look at some of my closest friends now and we've met maybe 3 or 4 times in person, but we message every single day.
That's interesting. I definitely appreciate like the benefit of meeting people in person, but I've never put it so clearly that like maybe just even one or two meetings can really make a huge difference. It's almost like, you know, diminishing returns, not to put it like weirdly in terms of relationships. Obviously there's people I see every day or, you know, all the time for years and years, but for people you meet online, it's not like you need to, you know, force yourself to have like regular in-person contact just to maintain the relationship. You can actually just meet once or twice, maybe over, you know, maybe years apart and, you know, stay in touch mainly online. And that can be a really strong relationship. The other question that sort of leads to is another thing that we touched on a bit before the conversation, but basically the concept of, especially in this post-COVID world, how, you know, you and I are both around the same age, like in our older 20s. I guess that's sort of a, you know, oxymoron, older 20s, but we're young and we have like a lot of time ahead of us, I think, and I hope, and we're in this sort of like adventurous, like exploratory mode. And we both assumed, like, I think for you, London, for me, maybe New York, respectively, that we had to like stay in these, you know, hotspot cities where we have a lot of like built up, you know, we have a lot of relationships and friends and everything. And there's a ton of jobs and just opportunities and whatnot. And with COVID, with work going remote and a lot of, I don't know about you, but like me personally, a lot of my friends are now, they've left New York for one place or another, and there's no like critical mass any one place in particular necessarily anymore. And it's hard to justify, especially when you have to work, you know, not have to, but I like working remote and expect to continue to do so. And I'll probably be working a lot from home. So you want a little more space. So basically like all of these considerations have changed around where to live. And maybe we can have that discussion a little bit. I'd love to hear sort of your thoughts and how traveling has informed them a bit. And maybe I'll figure out where I'm going to spend some of the next few years by talking it out with you.
Yeah, it's one I thought long and hard about. As soon as, I don't think people have fully thought through the consequences of remote work. I'm always trying to extrapolate a few years ahead. And the first thing that you realize is, if we pause the travel conversation for a second, the labor market is so much greater. So rather than, and that's good and it's bad. So from an employer perspective, you can hire talent everywhere, or at least certainly on time zones that are relevant to you. The good and the bad, so it's the best thing ever to happen to very talented people in the developing world, but it's probably the worst thing to ever happen to skillless or maybe, I don't know the correct word, maybe not as motivated people in the developed world, because there's suddenly going to be a lot more competition. So that's one side of it you've got to consider. Then when it comes to like location and where to live, it opens up that way. You don't need to be in London. You don't need to be in New York anymore. And then you go, oh shit, like, why was I living in London in a box paying £1,300 or $1,300 for rent when I could go somewhere much cheaper and save a lot of money, or I could get a lot more sun. And it really begins to make you think about what you want out of a location. It then makes you also think that, I think people talk about startup cities, and I think it's a good metaphor, but one thing that I think people have missed is New York's and LA's and London's to some regards are not, they're the big corporates, right? And some of them will continue to survive. And some of these startup cities, probably most of them are going to flop, but a few that have the right attributes, I think, will win. And I'm fascinated to see what happens there. I think it's too tough to predict where's going to win. I think there's some early candidates, but it's going to get very, very good for the individual, I imagine, just projecting a few years ahead, because you're going to have a lot of game theory that goes on between countries where they're going to compete to bring digital nomads in. So it's going to be a fascinating few years. I think when COVID, if it does go back to normal, you'll see a swing back to the office for 2 to 3 months. And there'll be a lot of New York Times pieces and Vox pieces about the office is back and it's never been, the remote work's dead. But I suspect once workers realize how long they're taking into commute, how much it's costing them. I had a friend the other day who said he got asked to pay for COVID tests when he was returning to work rather than them offering to pay for them. And then people, and also you've got so much pent up travel. Like there's never been as much pent up travel since the Wright brothers started. So that means that I'm pretty bullish on the digital nomadic movement for certainly people who are earlier on in their life with less responsibilities.
Yeah, a bunch of interesting points there. I tend to agree with you on the last thing, which was basically like, now that people have seen what it's like to work remote, especially, you know, during COVID times, which had its own set of challenges, like you couldn't necessarily go to indoor restaurants, you know, in New York, at least, or other places in the US, certainly for the last several months, or you know, it was harder or whatever. So there was sort of like, and you know, your kids, if you're an adult, like your kids might be at home all day bothering you while you're trying to work or whatever it is. So it was sort of like this remote world suddenly, and in like almost like a worst case scenario, obviously like there's worse things, but you know, a pretty unusual scenario of the pandemic. And now coming out of the pandemic, people getting vaccinated and everything like that. I think people are going to realize that like there's a lot of elements, if they haven't realized already, there's a lot of elements about working remotely, such as like saving that commute time, just the freedom of like, you know, you can go for a run during lunch if you want or something like that.
Yes.
And taking advantage of like exercising during the day rather than like first thing in the morning or after work or whatever.
Say let's go left field for a second. Obviously you were thinking then about exploring, traveling, ignore location, ignore anything. when, let's say, you're designing your dream location slash locations, maybe, which is a separate fork in the conversation, what do you want? Like, if you build it up from like first principles, what do you want out of a location?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's always fun to get the interview flipped on me a little bit, but I think for
me, George.
There's a few key things. Like, one is, certainly the weather, and just like the amount, the hours in the day where there's some sun and some daylight. I don't necessarily like need to be on the beach. I've never really spent enough time on the beach to sort of like know what that's like, or what I would need, or to have that as like a prerequisite, but just generally like some greenery and some nice weather. That's like one thing, which is a big thing. Another is like some good food around. Maybe if I could find some friends to live around who can cook really well, that could swap in. But I do like to like get a good meal a week or something like this. And other than that, like, I don't really care about like stores or anything else retail. I would say it's just like a couple good restaurants, and I don't need a bunch, but just a couple. And those are like both pretty easy to accomplish. Time zone becomes a thing where maybe that's not like from first principles, but sometimes it's like something that you need that is a little bit outside of your control. Right now, I don't really have to worry about that. And then the thing I think is a big thing that's challenging, at least in my mind, is, I think there's a lot of cities that could be, or towns or whatever, that could be a ton of fun and a really enjoyable place to live if you have a few good friends there that you're living with. Not that you're living with necessarily like in the same place, but that live around, just like a good group of people that you like. And it's tough to, so that's why a lot of people, obviously, they graduate school or whatever, and they end up living where they went to school or living where they grew up. And some people go out and adventure and they sort of go in an uncomfortable place where they don't know as many people, but then they meet people and they become comfortable there. But it's sort of hard to get a group of friends to go and relocate somewhere. And that's something that's like interesting to me, especially when, like you said, meeting people online, you find similar people with similar sort of criteria for where they want to live. And then maybe you can sort of agree amongst, four or five guys or girls or whatever it is. Let's go try out, Jackson, Wyoming, or whatever it is, some off the beaten path town or city. There's a lot of these places that satisfy the criteria I mentioned of like weather, a couple good restaurants, and some nature. So that's my short answer. Not like super picky, but I think people, weather, like some, a good place to run outside or whatever, and some good food. How about you?
Yeah, one dream I've always had, it's possible to come true, I guess, with the new trends that I have a friend of mine who tells me off for this, but I'm a bit of a manic ambivert, right? So she's into psychology and denies that you can be a manic ambivert, but it's a good mental model to have, where I feel that I have extreme introversion and extreme extroversion. So I can be in the room and be the loudest person, but I could also be in a room by myself for 3 weeks. And that's kind of reflected in my location choices, where I'd love to be right in the middle of like a city center for half the year, and then the other half the year in the mountains with nobody around. Mm-hmm. So rather than just one specific location, I'd probably like two locations, because if you try to get both those things in one, you kind of get neither. So I'd way rather have a mix of two different locations and the ability to switch it. I think, because my issue with traveling when I was younger is it's really hard to be ambitious and travel at the same time. You'd have to be in a hostel with a load of people doing copious amounts of drugs, talking about why everything's designed to keep you in a little box. And that's a reference from Peep Show, if anybody gets that one. So, and I just felt there's no ambition there. There's no meaning. But now with COVID or post-COVID with remote work, it opens up the ability to still maintain ambition and be traveling. Whereas previously you can't, the usual experience would be you'd save up a load of money, go traveling and burn it all, which I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But it now opens up this type A personality's ability to travel, which I find fascinating. But in terms of the specific location, I'd probably want one or two locations that I move between rather than one specific location, or maybe one location I'm in for 6 months, one location I'm in for 3 months, and then four locations I'm in for the other 3 months. So I don't really look at it as one set specific location, because I find that no location has everything. Because by very definition, often a strength is sometimes the weakness. So a strength of a place like New York is the fact that you're in a loud, busy city. But I also say the weakness is the fact you're in a loud, busy city. I realize that most strengths are directly related to weaknesses. So that's why I'm kind of cautious to say 12 months all year, one place. I'd much rather split it up. That's when I really began to think about it. There's not that many people discussing it like that, but that seems way more optimal than just one location.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I agree, not just like to appease you or like agree for the sake of agreement or anything like that. Like, I actually have that same, or at least a very similar set of preferences. And it's like demonstrated by, you know, what I've been doing. Like, since COVID, I've stayed in 4 or 5 different Airbnbs for at least a month. And even before COVID, I had like some allergy to, you know, like 12 month leases. Basically, I did like a 6 month and a 3 month, and I think a 9 month or something like this. But they're very rare. And it's sort of, I guess maybe it's something, a part of the system that could change. And certainly like Airbnb will probably benefit from people with similar preferences. But Airbnb tends to be, you know, if you want to stay somewhere for like 3 to 6 months, Airbnb is like not a very good deal. I mean, it's fine. It might be better than most other options, and you can get a nice place that's been reviewed and everything like that from like a trusted provider, but it's not the type of economics that you expect from like a 12-month lease in most cities. So I'll be curious to see, I guess, if the world adjusts a bit to accommodate for people like you and I who might want to live somewhere, you know, in a city. And the other thing, so you mentioned sort of, you know, the trade-off between city and rural. Another thing that I've been doing is actually basically chasing the weather, where like right now I'm in New York and have been for April and May, which in my mind are like two of the nicest months of the year to be here. But I'm out of here at the end of May. I don't want to be in New York for the summer. Just like I didn't want to be here for the winter when, you know, with the COVID restrictions, it wasn't all that attractive a place to be in my mind. I'd much rather have a lot of space and, you know, a fireplace or whatever it is. So it'll be interesting to see, I think, if the world just, I'm not aware of anything that's like a great hack for sort of achieving the type of lifestyle that you talked about. Are you aware of anything, or you're just sort of in the same boat as me, hoping it and waiting to see?
Yeah, I don't think there's any specific thing as of yet. One of the things that then becomes an interesting conversation as well is the amount of companies that are being born and are probably being born that we're not even aware of just yet, that comes about from like a relatively digitally nomadic life. So one of the biggest pain points is a Wi-Fi connection. Having to rely on Wi-Fi is an absolute nightmare. So I would love to get, I mean, obviously Starlink, 5G, et cetera. If you follow the directional arrows of progress, which is sort of a mental model of just following the way trends are moving, you can assume over time that internet's getting stronger and stronger. You're going to be able to get it in more and more remote places. So you then imagine a scenario of a laptop where there's constant 4G, 5G in it with a portable laptop there. And that then begins to reduce the friction of remote work further. One of the biggest things as well is there's not that many that I'm aware of like devices for posture whilst you're doing remote work. When you have a home office, you can get a lot more screens, a lot better setup for your neck, et cetera, et cetera. That problem's not been fully solved yet. So it's not just the location specific, but there's a lot of intangibles or like working setups that needs to be fixed just yet. However, that market is going to be huge. As somebody does a lot, we'll do a lot in e-commerce and tech space. I think there's like a huge room for a Shopify site or an Amazon marketplace style for just that's purely aimed at digital nomads. And like the amount of tech products that you can come up with, the amount of physical products that you can come up with, and that market is only going to boom. Yeah, there's so many nodes of like ideas that come about as a result of this.
Yeah, I think COVID obviously was, you know, not a good thing, but for guys like you and I think there's a lot of elements from the fallout that will sort of tailor the world in a little bit towards some of our preferences as like digital nomad inclined people. I never actually really like called myself that, but I think I pretty much fit the bill. And certainly like just the,
it needs a rebrand.
Yeah. I don't even know what exactly it means, but I get this image in my mind of the people in the hostel, like you talked about, and that's not really, that's not really me, but
we've done mushrooms for like the 30 days in a row. And it's like, okay. Interesting. But I find that one of the things I'd say, this comes into a fork of the conversation where my favorite thinkers right now, so two of them that come to mind are Balaji and Eric Weinstein. And I think more than anybody that I found online, at least, create ideas or words more than anybody. And it creates something that I've never really fully been able to understand or even explore. However, I use a good example. So there's the word influencer, okay? And influencer has been used for the last 5 to 10 years. And when people use that word, they're often referring to probably somebody who's been on reality TV. They're now on social media and they sell Herbalife and they sell shitty products via it. And as a result, the word influencer began to get a negative connotation towards it. And it meant that pursuing or being like coming across as an influencer had all these negative connotations. And all of a sudden, then somebody kind of birthed the word, or it began to rocket up in the Google Trends, of the word creator and the creator economy. And even though most creators, I mean, technically part of the whole influencer work, there are specific almost break off piece of it where it's a bit more authentic and it's a bit more about pursuing passions rather than just doing it purely to sell products. It now becomes a lot more acceptable. And I find that the word digital nomad still screams of somebody who's, it might be just sat in the hostel, doing nothing, just moaning about things constantly. And it needs a rebrand. And I find that that's what Weinstein and Balaji do very, very well, of creating words or concepts that then flip the script. And as soon as you then either place a word and have like a positive way of framing it, it gives that behavior a lot more permission to be acted upon. So one of my favorite examples is Weinstein has a few. So he has one called High Agency, which I'd never been able to describe before, which is this concept of being able to have like a locus control over your life. If people are saying no, you try and come up with an answer to say yes. And previously, the only word that was used was maybe disagreeable or stubborn, but it wasn't that, because disagreeable or stubborn is often somebody who might be, it's more of a negative framing of that personality trait. Whereas when you change it to high agency, it's more of a positive framing of that placeholder that you're trying to describe, essentially. And I think that the need to invent language, invent words, is probably going to be one of the biggest trends. Or I think it's a huge thing that is massively under discussed right now. And if you can create words for things, you can change reality, because all of a sudden people have placeholders or new placeholders to refer to.
Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously language sort of is at the root of everything. I saw a clip or a tweet of the Weinstein, I don't know if it was High Agency, but a different, I think it might've been High Agency, where basically he was talking about, or you were writing how he was talking about, I forget the name of the experiment, but basically there's like four lines on a piece of paper. Yeah. And there's one line, and then the other three are like, you know, the people in the room are asked, all right, which of these three lines matches the one line in length? And it's like obvious that like one is the same length and the other two are just blatantly not, and it's not close. Like you couldn't possibly get it wrong. But some people, there's like someone who's staged in the room, maybe, and maybe you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but there's someone who's like staged in the room to say the wrong answer. And then like a certain percentage of the rest of the people will just copy the wrong answer, because they're basically like, oh, like there must be something that like I'm not seeing or something. Like they literally just don't even trust their eyes to like look at these two lines that are the same length. And I don't know if this was High Agency or something else, but Weinstein, I think, came up with a word to talk about the person who is like, you know, screw that. Like this line is the same length as this line. That's the right answer, right?
He calls it it's within that family. He calls it Ash negative. So the test was, I think it's by Solomon Ash, or certainly the name of the last name of the psychologist was Ash. And yeah, it's just how you describe. If you want a more modern version of it, my top three shows of all time, go on Netflix and watch Derren Brown, The Push. So he's a magician, illusionist in the UK, but he does these crazy reality stunts. And he does an experiment where people don't know they're being filmed. And he slowly but surely, in the spaces of 90 minutes, gets agreeable people to slowly conform. So he'll ask to begin with for them to, the sausage rolls there, and they have to do the vegan menu as well. And because there's no vegetarian or vegan products in stock, they just change the signs over. So they slowly start saying yes to this person. And at the end of the show, he gets them to kill somebody. And it goes to show this slow chipping away, that frog in the boiling water. Charlie Munger has that bit where I think the frog in the boiling water metaphor, where you throw a frog in cold water and slowly heat it up, it jumps out right. I'm sorry, it never jumps out. But if you throw it in boiling water, it immediately jumps out. And he says that's probably bullshit about frogs. I don't think the actual study has been replicated, but it's certainly true of human beings. And Derren Brown shows in that show how you can slowly, with somebody who is low agency or just a human being, you can chip away and chip away. Even my phone screensaver now, it's literally the person from the show pushing the person off a building because they slowly got chipped away at. And that is such a useful concept, but it's not taught anywhere. If anything, it's the opposite of being taught, both in our, I mean, we're not hardwired to do it genetically. And then school kind of compounds on that further. I don't know how you do it in an ethical way. However, I do think this, before you pass school or however the future of school looks, you should have to get almost an Ash negative score. And if you did that, I think society would be significantly better, and you'd prevent a lot of people going along with horrendous events. People think about it like peer pressure or like not doing drugs or things like that, which is obviously potentially important. However, when you reframe it and you think about the societal implications of people being able to think through for their actions and having a positive word to use for that, it's fucking important.
Yeah. So this is, yeah, I think you said it was the background on your phone. Is that right?
Yeah. I watched it the other night again, and I was like, wow. I mean, this then pauses the conversation, which is background. I have a thesis that backgrounds on screensavers, phones and laptops work for about 5 days, then you get used to them. So I've always wanted to design an app that literally changes it between about 100 images. But right now I've only had it for about 2 days. So I'm like, it's going to hit home, and then I'm sure I'll surely get used to it. But every time I pick up the phone, I just see, I don't want to spoil everything. It's worth watching, but a woman in there, yeah. One of the participants ends up, or at least it's an actor who she pushes off and he's attached to a bungee cord. It's all fine. However, goes on to commit murder. And that for me is always, yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. It's funny. It's an interesting theory about the phone background thing. I was going to ask, you know, why basically that was your background, because I was basically projecting like an overemphasized maybe meaning that it might have to you, because like for my phone background, I haven't changed in like a couple of years. But it sounds like that's just a part of the rotation and a useful thing to remember. And then in 3 days, you'll be on to the next one. So one thing, yes, I want to get into, you know, you bring up these sort of mental models and this general like first principles thinking like reflexively. And it's obvious, like basically, I think it's a great, you know, to keep it so top of mind and just to go about life with this way of thinking, I think will pay huge dividends in the long term if it hasn't begun to already. Just thinking everything through deeply and applying these sort of cross-discipline ways of thinking and mental models to basically everything that like comes into you, before sort of reacting out. A few of the people who I think you've got the most sort of inspiration from, or learned a lot from at least, is, you mentioned Charlie Munger, Naval Ravikant, mm-hmm, who you created Naval Bot, any others that you want to sort of bring up, and would love to hear just like, if you only had a few minutes to talk about each of them, with, well, today with the people listening in, what are like the most important things you've learned from these individuals?
Oh, that's a great question. It's like hard to even,
I know you've got like a library.
Vocalize it, right?
Yeah. I know you've got like a library for each of them. So it's challenging, but I would love to hear just how you respond. It doesn't have to be the single most important thing, but the first things that come to mind maybe is an easier question.
Well, yeah, so it's a great question. So what I probably look at to begin with is the similarities between the two. So what I can only describe as disgusting levels of curiosity and a religious love of clear thinking. Is the similarity between the two. Another one on there who I know like Charlie and Warren are massively hated in the crypto communities these days, but I've been working on an idea for a while, a Warren Buffett metaphor, which I think is the most underrated one, which I'd love to explore with you now, actually. So there's something, it's like a mental model I've been trying to develop, which I call it Buffett coins, right? So this is the one that I've been thinking about most for the last 6 weeks. And Warren Buffett gave this speech at Nebraska, I think, in like the late 90s. And he's talking to other college people. I never really got picked up the speech. And it's his best ever piece of advice or best ever insight I found, which is he says to them, all these young students, you go around at your classmates and think about who you would invest in. And so you put a little bit of money in and you own 10% of their earnings for the rest of their life. And it's a really interesting like question, right? I'm sure you begin to think about, like even now, Jake, if you begin to think about like people that you know, friends or associates, people you've been online, who you'd invest in, it's an interesting question. Where would you get the best return? So like one of the things, you don't have to say who, but of interest, do you have anybody who like begins to spring to mind that if you could invest in, you'd get 10% of their earnings for the rest of their life?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I think for me, I would actually, you know, there's a ton of people. And the reason I say that is not because I think I would be right every time, but I would diversify just like a venture capitalist in seed stage companies, knowing that a number are going to fail. I think, you know, if I could make a dozen investments in people that I know, whether it's people from, you know, growing up in college or people who I've met online in the last several months, I could put together a list of 12 where I could tell a story of how they become enormously successful in the next, you know, over the course of their lifetime for each of them. And of course, maybe only one of them works out or two of them works out or whatever. But I would love to do something like that.
Well, here's the question, right? So then, I mean, you're kind of seeing this like play out a little bit with like platforms like BitClout, right? But let's move away from the crypto metaphor. And you go into the metaphor of like, okay, let's say for those 12 people that you were kind of loosely having in your head right then, well, Buffett then asks, he goes, why? So let's ignore all the finances. Like, that's actually irrelevant. It just gets you thinking, like, why would you invest in them? And then this has always been the most powerful thing for me. You then begin to look at values that people have or mental models that people have or ideas that people have or operating systems that they have. And you go, that's the reason why I'm investing in them. So it's almost like personality as a business model, and mental models is part of that. Genetics is part of that. There's loaded array of factors, and you've got to assume there's nobody who's just got a rich father. There's no great divorce settlements coming up. It's all purely based on merit. And why would you invest in them? And then you begin to go, okay, but I look at a few people. So I have a friend of mine, a guy called Harry, who runs a cool Twitter page called Marketing Examples. Good friend of mine. And I always think about him and I go, I'd invest in him because he's like level of focus is unlike very few people I've seen before. So I go, okay. And then I look at my business partner, Josh. He's very high agency. I always has a great locus of control, always goes the extra mile for people. He's always willing to put his wallet on the line, pay for things, pay over the top, help people out. And you begin to do that across your portfolio and you begin to develop like a variety of personality traits you'd invest in. And then he gets you to flip the script and he says, who would you short? And it's why. And then you begin to look at sort of ideas or mental models that people have in their head or behaviors and patterns, whether it's somebody selfish, whether it's they're greedy, whether it's they're very lazy, whatever it is, right? and you begin to piece together the system. And then the crazy thing at the end is you kind of throw out this like money metaphor and you realize you kind of just establish your values, certainly for making money. And you go, okay, am I doing X? And then am I running away from Y? I think introspection is actually kind of overrated. So even if you look at studies, right, when people have bad breath, it's very hard for them to notice because they're used to it, but you can see it in other people very, very clearly. The next fork in the argument is, okay, but who cares about money, right? There's more important things than money. And the reason why I call it Buffett coins is because it then forks off. So you could almost imagine you were looking at your friends and you go, there's a weird crypto that comes along, which every time they smile, I get 10% of the smile. Every time they laugh, I get 10% of their laughs. So you almost own like 10% of their happiness, 10% of their joy. Who would you invest in and why? And then you break that down again and you've kind of established your values for happiness. And then you flip the script again and you go, who would I short if happiness was a coin? And you begin to establish your values for being more happy. And then you apply it for health, anything that you want to learn. And almost by this looking outwards, you can then introspect. You can study a lot of mental models, but when you begin to put them together into your own words, create new words and build on top of them, you begin to understand it a little bit more than just reading Farnham Street and being able to quote things very, very fast.
Yeah, that's a great story and like a great thought experiment, I think, to run through, I think. And the point about introspection being overrated, I think, is very interesting. That certainly seems like a valuable approach to sort of find these things about yourself through looking at the others around you. When I think about those characteristics that I see in others that I value, I can appreciate that it is sometimes hard. Like it's hard to come up with things like these hacks or like thought exercises are useful because it's hard to just go from like some ambiguous question to an answer. And then what people tend to do is they just take answers from other people. Like you said, you know, you go and you read Farnham Street and you say, okay, there's my answer or whatever it is. And I thought it's kind of interesting, like this concept of first principles. I think I tend to think of things like maybe, you know, not completely or anything, probably not as much as you, but more than the average person. And I've always thought it was sort of funny, the idea of first principles, because you're like the quote unquote first principles that often are spread around are oftentimes, you know, developed by other people and they might be good. Like certainly I've taken a ton of lessons that are like one that you're obviously super familiar with super familiar is an understatement, is like Naval's How to Get Rich podcast going off the tweet storm. And there's just some amazing insights in there that like really, I just like latch right on. It's like, that is brilliant. Like, and so simple, like I'm all in. But if your entire sort of knowledge base is built off of these things, it's like how much first principles thinking are you really doing if you're just taking everyone else's first principles? Not to say again that they're not super valuable, I think they are, but just sort of an interesting aside on first principles. How do you think about that?
It's quite a meta question, right? Because then you have to think about it from a first principles. I think the way I'd approach it is beginning to have various different sandboxes in your head. So I mean, let's pause first principles for a second so I can come back to it. I think there's a valuable exercise of almost having a chairman of the board, of like having a load of different people in your head who you ask questions to. And you go, would they approve of this message? Well, how would they think about that? And you isolate that as its own individual exercise because there's still value to that. There's still value from learning from other people's mistakes. There's so much value. There's this incredible amount of value. However, when it comes to the first principles side of things, I think you almost have to get as near to logic and mathematics as you can and as near to simplicity as you can. I find it a lot easier to think from first principles, weirdly, when I've exercised a lot. Before a sauna session or before a long run, my mind is 1 + 1 = 2. And I can really begin to strip away all the excess fat in the thinking through of the problem and really begin to understand it from a simple perspective. So I'd say, I think that's the biggest mistake I've made previously of just trying to think my way through to first principles when my brain's fucked. So fixing harder to begin with, and then your mind is so much calmer and it has a lot less insecurities and thought processes that are constantly running. Then I find it a lot easier to sit down with a piece of paper and almost look at it as if this, then that statements. It should almost be yes and no's and a series of whys. And if you have that, or at least when I have that, I find I'm getting nearer and nearer to some form of first principles.
Yeah, that's a useful way to think about it, I think, for sure. I want to wrap up with one concept that you told me you've been thinking about a lot recently, which is sort of contrasting psychological innovation versus technological innovation. It's a little bit out of left field here, but I didn't want to wrap the podcast until we got to it. So could you tell me, just lay it on me, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, this is a mental model that comes from Rory Sutherland that I've been trying to build upon a lot. Again, going back to the start of an obsession with psychology, an obsession with technology. The whole concept of the two things are, so everybody kind of knows technological innovation. I think Peter Thiel's definition of technology is the ability to do more with less. So it's the ability to make the laptop have more memory, make it faster, make the car electric, make it faster, make it more eco-friendly. It's very clear what technological innovation is. However, Sutherland has this point where we're so obsessed with technological innovation, which obviously has its place. It's the reason why me and you are living past certain ages and we're not all dying of certain diseases. So it certainly has its place. But psychological innovation, Sutherland's argument is you can reframe things and fix what would have been the problem. So he uses the example of one of the things that rail did incredibly well was having clear time boards of when the train's going to come. So it would say it's going to arrive in 5 minutes or it's going to arrive in 15 minutes. And fixing the uncertainty in the human brain, which took it's still technology because it's an LED board, but it took a £2,000 or dollar LED board versus 10 billion making the trains go faster. So psychological innovation is the ability to just simply reframe things and make it better. So even Sutherland says that Uber's best thing wasn't just the technology. It's for the first time ever, you can see when the taxi driver is about to arrive. So you're not dealing with that uncertainty. And all of a sudden you're giving it new life that you would have had to have done by technology. So another good example is, it's all rail at the minute today, but on the train, for example, having in the UK, you have the seats on the left and you have the seats on the right and you have a pathway down the middle that people stand up on. And it means there's no real advantage at all to standing in the middle, which makes people fucking fuming. Rory has this argument where if you could flip things on the head, where you could have where people, the seats were in the middle, and if you stood at the outside, you could get a nice view and charge your phone. All of a sudden, you've made the population of the train so much happier because everybody's winning. So rather than having to rebuild massive trains, you can just reframe the system or reframe the flow of things. And you've arguably done as much innovation as a technological innovation. And I think that's massively, massively underappreciated. And there's so much talk about technological innovation, but so little talk about psychological innovation.
So the psychological innovations, like you talk about changing the train car or, different sort of communal elements like this. And I know I promised last question, but I'm curious, is this something where you think, do you think also about not only like society sort of psychologically innovating, but on an individual level, sort of not just innovating on like how you use technology or whatever, maybe that is psychological innovation if it's the using of technology. But do you think of psychological innovation as much on a personal level as on like a societal level?
Oh, 100%. I mean, it even goes back to what we're talking about earlier of the power of having new placeholders and new words for things is almost a technology within itself. I mean, you could argue that language might be one of the oldest forms of technology. The ability for us to be able to communicate back and forth is quite a unique human skill. So that within itself is a huge thing. And I think there's a lot to say about at an individual level, the ability to reframe things that people haven't really thought through. So I even use this is a mental model. It's a very simple one that everybody understands of just contrast and how powerful the drug contrast is. So I've been tinkering with this idea of, it originally comes from Munger, where you've got a lukewarm bucket in the middle. You've got an ice cold bucket over here of water and a boiling hot bucket of water over here. And you put both hands in the two, for 5 minutes. So you've got one hand in freezing water, one in boiling water, and then you put it in the lukewarm water. The one that was in the freezing water feels really hot in this lukewarm water, and the one that was in the boiling water feels really cold in this lukewarm water. And that's always stuck in my mind about the power of psychological innovation, where just changing the framing beforehand has completely changed your experience of reality, despite the fact that lukewarm bucket of water is the exact same temperature. So that applies to so many different things. I've found that it's a bit stoic, it's a bit dark, but what I'll go back to sometimes when I'm sad or down, I'll watch a Jocko Willink podcast where he's reading a book about a Japanese prisoner of war called Forgotten Highlander. And this guy is in the worst torture camp ever. He ends up in Nagasaki, Hiroshima. Horrendous things happen to him. And after reading that, even though my life's exactly the same, I'm so much more fucking grateful, so much happier, versus when I'm watching or when I'm scrolling through Instagram and looking at people bawling and just chatting shit. Even though my experience, my actual me in the moment is the exact same person, it's fundamentally more different. And I've always wanted to, I don't know how to do it in the most tasteful way, but creating, imagine like a YouTube of just fucking content that makes you feel better, not just because it's dark or negative, it could be positive, but there's so much, that's why I kind of talk about the Lindy Library. There's so much small inputs you can put into the system that aren't this need for antidepressants or technology or new things that can change things that I don't think we've fully explored as a society yet.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Contrast. I've heard you talk about this in a number of different contexts as well. Like one great example that you brought up before was like Rolls Royce, I think, stopped selling at car shows and started selling it at aircraft shows because it was the cheapest thing at the latter, whereas it was the more expensive at the former. And it's like a no-brainer to buy it at an airplane show. So I think that contrast principle, that's obviously an extremely different example than the water buckets or Instagram, but it's just it's prevalent in a lot of different ways. Recently, like I was actually talking, forget who I was talking about this with, but basically this person was like, I don't like watching sad movies anymore. Like, I just don't like sad movies. And I said, I kind of like sad movies, like not because they're sad necessarily, but this person was like, sad movies make me feel bad. I was like, sad movies kind of make me feel good after, because you spend this hour or hour and a half or 2 hours or whatever in this like depressing like situation on screen or whatever. And then you get out and you're like, my life's pretty good. It's like bad dreams when you wake up from like a bad dream and you feel pretty grateful and pretty fortunate. And sometimes you wake up from a good dream and you're like, damn, that would have been nice. So it's this contrast, I think, is basically everywhere, and certainly an interesting thing to keep in mind, and maybe an interesting place to leave people.
Yeah. Just on that note, it feels that when people talk about psychological innovation as well, that they assume it's for every the same thing's going to be for everybody. The same way Reddit's not for fucking everybody. The same way Instagram's not for everybody. I think it goes back to the first principles thing. You notice there's constantly these meta blocks of the conversations that we have in. It goes back to the first principles thing of really figuring out what form of psychological innovation is going to A, work for you, B, work for consumers that you might be trying to market a product to, or C, work for people that you're trying to interact with to give them the best possible experience of reality. And it's a form of alchemy. You're turning shit into sugar. You're just by simply reframing thing, you're not changing the bits of it, but the hardware of it, you've changed reality.
Yep, definitely. And it's we'll wrap it up there, but these concepts, I'm sure we could go days and days. So it's been a pleasure talking with you, George, and thanks again for coming on the show. Where can people go to follow you on Twitter? You want them to go to the newsletter, point people in whatever direction they can go to learn more and follow some of your stuff.
Yeah, just Twitter is probably the best place. George_ Mac. I don't know who's got it without the underscores, as well as the newsletters in the bio as well. So those are the two main resources.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, George.
No worries. Keep it up, man. I love what you're doing.